That's a perfect introductory piece here, because I can't get it out of my head what our last guests were talking about, a potential, and they leaned toward probable, attack by Russian military elite intelligence forces through an al-Qaeda front on Wednesday, August 17th. And it's just kind of changing the way I'm thinking about our first few minutes with Dr. Fred Bell, who, as you know, is kind of an expert on everything. And I look forward to chatting with him coming up in just a second. But when we do, I'll start with the question, which may not have been first on my list originally, maybe not yours either. But I want to ask him about this advance of terrorism, world terrorism, and how he sees our future with hopefully a rise in planetary consciousness. How do those two things intersect, or how can one help us overcome the other? Next, we'll start there, but we'll have lots of room for so many topics on the way with Dr. Fred Bell on Coast to Coast AM. My name's Ian Punnett. Well, most of you know the work of Dr. Fred Bell after years on Coast to Coast AM. You can find out more from him by linking up to him at coasttocoastam.com. But I will say the author of Rays of Truth, Crystals of Light, former NASA scientist, business consultant, and also celebrity management. Always kind of an interesting tandem occupation working with the film industry and others. Still runs a company called Pyridine and has governmental ties. Dr. Fred Bell, good evening.
Hi, Ian. How are you doing? How's your pyramid?
Well, my only complaint is my pyramid hat wasn't really designed to go over headphones.
I know, they weren't. You know, I was hoping you didn't have to go to finishing school to learn how to wear it, but it sounds like you got it made if you could do it with headphones.
Well, like every time I lean forward, it slides off.
So. Yeah, I heard it hit the deck there. You know.
So I'm gonna have to wait till during the breaks.
Yeah, we're gonna have to get a receptor on you. Something easier to manage.
So let me ask you as a way of introducing you to people who don't know your work. If you were at a party and somebody asked you, "What do you do?" What do you say?
I don't know. I'm a student of the universe, I guess. I do lots of stuff. I've done a lot of things for the government, and by the way, I've got it up on a website. I'll tell you about that later. A lot of documents people wanted, and I've been developing a lot of consciousness-raising products for about 30 years. Pyridine's about 30 years old now, and we got distributors, and we're all over the world, and so that's been really important. The film thing that you mentioned, I'm in the movie business. I got into that for communication purposes because I was tired of seeing these stupid films of violence and all of it.
Right.
Because what I'm really about doing is making the planet a better place for the children. I could care less about some of the adults that don't really care. You know what I mean? But I got kids. I raised three daughters, and I really think it's necessary now to make a better place for the kids. And we got a lot of cleaning up to do. We got to clean up terrorists and oil spills and dirty governments, and we got a lot of work to do. But we'll do it. It's not a problem.
I'm interested in the film work, and I'll digress to that later on. Let's start there with the terrorists, because that's a fairly kind of ominous moment to float out through the rest of the show, that our last guest said that they anticipate some sort of attack August 17th.
Let me bring in data on that. I understand what they said. I listened to it. You know, I do some viewing here and there, and I'll take it back to where I got involved with this situation. It was at the end of the last 9/11. After 9/11, I did a little viewing, and Osama bin Laden left out of Tora Bora, and he went up through Tajikistan, into a town called Dushanbe. Dushanbe is kind of if you went up there, it's north of Afghanistan. If you went in there, that town would be like a bunch of pirates and wild, you know, outlaws. It's like 2,000 years old, so no CIA agent or no agent could bother him in there. He hung out there for a while, and then he went across the Hindustan Mountains up across the northern face of the Himalayas, went into China, up there in China, and then he went into a place and he was healed. He had some serious kidney problems. He went to healing for about 6 or 8 months. Then he left out of there and he went over to Laos in Cambodia. And when he was over there, a lot of terrorist activity happened in the Philippines, if you remember, the following spring and summer. So whenever this man moves around, I sort of got into his head by doing this viewing. You start to see the action. I have a kind of a pulse, a beat into the Homeland Security. I'm kind of tied in there through some friends. That's why we have Geiger counters and stuff on our website. And one of the big things that he's good at is making a disturbance somewhere else and going somewhere else. The whole thing over there in England recently was just a muse to distract everything. If you remember in our terrorist alerts, never ever one of them was any good. It's just all it does is play into their hands when they have orange alerts, red alerts. It's all BS. The only alerts that are necessary, I feel, are when some child gets kidnapped, and we have an orange alert looking for a kidnapped kid.
Right, an amber alert.
So other than that, but what happened was I got into the nuclear business when I was a kid, but a friend of mine developed this pocket device that goes in your pocket. It goes
right
on a keychain, and it's very important to have one of those now. And what happened was right after 9/11, he sold about 1 million of them over to the Homeland Security Department. And that's so we know when there's terrorist activity by how many nuclear detectors, these pocket machines that the Homeland Security buys. And they've been buying a few again. And what the estimate is now, what the real fear is based on a couple of facts. One fact is every day out in Texas in that way, enough dirty nuclear material is stolen from construction sites to construct a dirty bomb. And this has been going on for about 18 months. So, and this stuff could be micronized. And a dirty bomb is not an explosion. There's no gunpowder or any explosive force. It's nothing more than a micronized bunch of radioactive powder that's ionized, the ionizing radiation. It's put inside a canister. You go into someplace like the MGM Grand, check in, throw it into the air conditioning system, walk away. People don't even notice it for 24 to 30 hours. People get sick. They figure it's bad food. And finally, about 5 or 6 days later, people are already dosed so bad, now they're realizing there's a problem. Somebody's probably figured out by then, and by then some people are going to be dead in a couple of months. So that's the real danger. And then what happens is it hits our economy. Somebody says, well, the MGM Grand just got hit with this dirty nuke, and now nobody wants to go in the place for 15 years. So what happens in Nevada and Las Vegas? It's shut down. And that's because everybody's afraid to go there. It might happen to them. And that's kind of where they're at right now. That's because, you know, based on statistics that I've seen, you know, based out of Homeland Security. So that's, and they figure it's between now and the next 24 months this will probably happen. Yeah.
Now in the next, so I mean, you're not ruling out something soon as opposed to later.
No, nothing soon. It could happen at any time. This one thing. They've got other things that they'll do, but I don't see a bunch of Russian soldiers coming anywhere when they've got, you know, the cells are all disconnected and they financially they're not. You know, when Bush was running around attacking bank accounts and all that, that was silly because that's not how they do business at all. They do business with cash and they move it around in a very nice way, just like the drug lords do. And we don't seem to be doing very good against the war against drugs at all. The more we do against it, the bigger it gets. So it's
right,
the same
right,
thing
right.
with terrorism. The only way that you can fight terrorism is raise consciousness. That's the only way.
Well,
that's what we're doing.
Well, then help me with that, because, I mean, other than the – you mentioned the idea of a detector, right? I mean
– Yeah, we have a pocket detector. It lasts 12 years on one battery.
But what is it – what will that give me? I mean, I would think
– Okay, here's what it'll give you. If you're in the MGM Grand, this thing beeps about once every half an hour. And if you're in there and all of a sudden this thing starts going beep, 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 you better get out of there. And if you look at our website, you can actually look at one. You can actually you run a video and play with a little cursor and actually pretend that you're in a dirty area, and you can actually see the beeps change as you move it away. It's on our website. You can actually see this and have your own video demonstration of how it works. It's just a little keychain. It doesn't
right.
cost very much.
No.
And that's what I recommend everybody get, you know. I mean, they're really handy. That's what Homeland Security, that's what the government's using, you know, if you
and
want to know.
You said you sold about a million of those?
Yeah, my friend Sean did, yeah.
Who was that Sean David Morton?
No.
Okay. You sell those to them, and then they give them to whom?
The people that work there. Sean O'Connor is the name of the guy that developed them. He's over in Texas, but we sell them through us. They give them to the people that work for the government. All government people carry them. They carry them on their keychains
really?
Wherever they go. You know, everybody's got them over there.
They really?
They sold a million of them when that 9/11 for actually a couple million now. When they first ordered them, I'll tell you the story. Right after 9/11, he got a call. He's over in Austin, Texas, and they said, you know, we want to buy about, you know, a million of these things. We've only got 600,000 in my warehouse. And he says, okay, we'll take those. He says, okay, we'll get them ready. So he got them ready, and they said, now we want to come and get them. He says, well, I got to get paid. You know how slow the government is.
Right.
You know, paying. And that's what he says. I can't. I'm a little company. I can't give you my entire inventory. They said, no problem. Your cashier's check is coming FedEx right now. You'll have it in the morning. So the morning comes, there's the check, and I says, now how do I ship this thing? And he says we're not used to shipping this many. And he said, well, no problem, we'll send some jets. And so they sent in a couple of private jets, and he loaded up his pickup truck and everything that he had, and they went down there to the local airport in Austin and loaded up the planes, hauled them off. They wanted them right now. They had them within 48 hours, and they had them paid. It's amazing how quick they can move when they got to go. So now, because he's connected over there, and I am too, that we got a lot of, you know, we get a lot of good input at this point.
All right, so we have that, but then advancing planetary consciousness, help us understand how we can use that then to fight off these terrorist threats.
Well, it works through the mind. For example, one of the things that we've been working with for a long time is master crystals, a quartz piece, big large piece of quartz you put in your house. And if you go down to Arkansas where they mine them, and you go in certain shops, people will walk into that shop and you'll say, oh, look at that nice crystal, I want to buy it, because they got crystal for sale. And the people will say, no, that one's not for sale. And they'll say, why not? Because that's our master crystal, that protects our shop. And basically what happens is, if they're not around, the place is closed, some thief comes up and wants to break into their shop, that crystal will put out an energy field that will make that thief get paranoid and go away. And terrorism works on paranoia. So you have to put up a field of energy, you know, not only from your brain, but other objects around you that puts this field out that makes them get very scared and very nervous, and they're very easy to penetrate into their consciousness. It's not a hard thing to do. But at the same time, because of the way their religious practices work, they look at Americans, because most Americans, a lot of Americans are in denial about how they live and how they work over here. And because of that, the terrorists feed on that. Americans are typically easy to scare because they don't really do their due diligence. They're too busy trying to make their ends meet because they live beyond their means. And so they leave themselves very vulnerable to world politics. So it's a gradual enlightenment process that has to go on, and a gradual consciousness that comes from within by understanding and educating yourself to some degree that has to be done. And until then, people are going to be very, very vulnerable.
Well, why not put up master crystals all around the border of the United States?
Well, you wouldn't work that way, because master crystal is just one way of doing it. There's much more modern technology now. NAELF devices, all kinds of different things that we're putting to work now. There's these holographic projectors that we build. There are pictures of them on your website tonight. That kind of technology is where we're at right now. And by the way, the government, I might add, has three major projects, which Art Bell's been talking about to some of his guests, along similar lines about how that stuff works.
Well, tell me what that means.
Well, what that means is, this is a hologram. Our universe is a hologram. And When you look at on your shows, have you ever talked about scalar waves much?
No, and I saw that in your book. I was reading that chapter actually earlier today.
Okay, scalar waves are trapezoidal, non-time, non-electromagnetic waveforms that are put together by thought processes. For example, if you were to start a company like John Carter Sr. did, called IBM, International Business Machines, he got a dream one night. All right, the next day he got up and he went to the drawing board and he started developing a computer. Pretty soon he actually made a prototype. From that prototype, he went out and sold a few. Then he had employees working for him, and he created a huge thought form. This big thought form would be called a scalar wave. Now, the moment he had the dream and got out of bed and went to work, the thought form was complete. It had no time, but there was time involved in recruiting all the employees, getting all the people together, and making his company work. So there's a time factor before consciousness, people out on the planet, realize what his vision was. It might have taken a year or two. You follow me?
I'm trying to. So, because this, you believe that scalar waves are also what is tied in with the power of the pyramids.
Well, the power of the pyramid, okay, the pyramid has no power. The pyramid's a shape.
Right.
Anytime you take matter and form it into some shape, it displaces space and time and creates an energy field. For example, the red blood cell in your body is pyramid shaped. There's in the red blood cell and hemoglobin are two alpha, two beta chains. And they're complete octahedrons. So you got four octahedrons, you know, stacked one upon the other inside your red blood cell. What that does, that shape, what that does is it takes oxygen and delivers it to the cell and picks up carbon dioxide and brings it back out through your lungs. And it does it on a rhythm called the Bohr effect. It's a cyclic pattern that's created by that shape. You know, we don't have three-sided pyramids inside our body for blood. That exists in chlorophyll for plants, and plants do the opposite. Plants take in carbon dioxide and give off oxygen. So the shape, it's the shape that counts first. First you go to the shape. From the shape, then you develop compounding shapes. You mean compounding energy fields, which then makes the metabolism, then makes a cell, an organ, and on and on and on.
Okay, but then tie that in for the pyramids for me. So what you're saying is that what is the actual power then that comes from them?
Okay,
once we have the shape,
I got
then
it.
What?
I got what you want. Okay, the energy, there's seven levels of energy. There's seven levels of consciousness, okay, in the universe. And these levels of consciousness are feelings. Love is a feeling, compassion, feeling for another is a feeling. That's a consciousness. Inside the body, you have seven endocrine glands and seven sets of hormones that release these hormones onto the receptor sites in the brain, allowing you to experience through your physical body these different feelings. That same energy also, when it's balanced, creates a pH way up in the alkaline range. If you take a pyramid, for example, and put it over something, the pH of what it produces over what object it's on is also will swing to the alkaline range. So it begins to give us an indicator of what this is. The next experiment you can do is we used to make, when I had a company, was working for a company called Pyramid Power 5, we used to take brine shrimp. Brine shrimp are very much like a single cell in the human body.
Aren't those sea monkeys?
Yeah.
Isn't that what they sell in the magazine is sea monkeys?
I think so. I'm not sure what they call them now.
I think that's brine shrimp. But anyway, go
ahead. Well, anyway, we would take a control group, put them away from the pyramid, another group in the pyramid. The ones in the pyramid would live a year. The control group would die in about 10 or 12 weeks because the energy, the electromagnetic forces and everything in the universe killed them all. So what happens is we found that there is a life force within the pyramid. Then we started doing kinesiology. The reason you're wearing one of those right now is because of a guy named Dr. Gary Couture back in 1974 at a health clinic in Newport Beach, California, was working with a guy named John Thee, who developed this kinesiology over at Pasadena at the university up there, and it became a world-renowned thing. We found that by testing, like, for example, with kinesiology, different vitamin points on your body, vitamin C, calcium, and if you were weak in that area and we're testing you, your arm would collapse or whatever muscle that we were putting pressure on would collapse as soon as we went to that area testing for that. We found that when you put the pyramid over the body, every single area, regardless of what vitamin area it was, tested strong. Now, what a vitamin? A vitamin is a piece of biochemistry that produces a consciousness or light-enhancing force, a light force into the body, because vitamins were made from plants that absorb sunlight, which then are transmuted into the ATP molecule in the body, which then produces glycogen and energy. So the pyramid, therefore, would give you energy because it acts like a vitamin, you know, anywhere in the body. And there are seven different types of vitamins that go into the seven categories of consciousness. So once again, now we've found that the life force in the pyramid, is seven frequencies of energy, just like it makes you animate, what makes your body. When you wear that on your head, it puts you into an alpha state. It also starts a detoxing process in the brain. So it does a whole lot of things. And what we did with the early pyramids back in 1974, most of our clients were Valium, strung out on Valium, the American housewife. This is before the days of cocaine. And the biggest drug addict in the 1974 period was a housewife on Valium. So we were able to, and they needed to be calmed down. They were uptight. They were upset. So
mother's little helper.
Exactly, because the husbands were getting carbon monoxide out on the freeways for 8 hours, driving to and from work, coming back all gassed out and angry. So the housewife had to take the Valium to deal with the husband. That was part of our society. And we did a lot of tests over at University of California, Irvine, during that time, looking at the hormone changes in the husbands due to getting gassed every day.
Hmm.
And it still goes on. You know, it got all the way up to freeway shootings, and that's a whole other topic. But
I would love to explore that sometime.
Oh, yeah, I could take you right through it. That's not a problem. I know all the chemical changes that go on. It's over a period of time, about 7 years, and it pretty much messes you up for good. You know?
Well, I happened to run into an incident like that driving in this evening. It was, fortunately, didn't involve shooting, but on the highway, two people playing this ridiculous cat-and-mouse game. It wasn't even that crowded out, I mean, in terms of traffic, but, boy, they were going at it like crazy. And so that's just been on my bean, actually, this evening. Well, all right, then I'll return to that topic, I hope, at some point.
Anywhere you want to go.
Bunch of emails in this evening with various questions based on past shows with Dr. Fred Bell. I want to ask you, though, coming up about energy, about personal energy.
Sure.
In light of the fact that, you know, oil is a 66
dollars. Yeah, let's talk about that.
Okay, and the highest we've ever been paying for gasoline in this country, it doesn't look like that's going to stop anytime soon.
Let me tell you about Henry Ford.
Okay.
Let me tell you a story that's going to make all your listeners very angry.
Okay, well, then we'll do that. Coming up next with Dr. Fred Bell. You know his work, of course, for many years. His new book, Rays of Truth, Crystals of Light. And at some point this evening, I have to ask him about space-time singularities and miniature event horizons and how we can create these in our own environment. I'm fascinated by that. We'll see where that goes. Coming up next with Dr. Fred Bell on Coast to Coast AM, my name's Ian Punnett. Coming up with Dr. Fred Bell, I'm making a list. I'm not going to forget any of these. The holographic waves, it's kind of his new thing, and these wave packets, wave technology. Got to ask him about that. The change in metabolism that was once measured in freeway commuters after being exposed to all of those exhaust fumes. What can we do about those exhaust fumes from fossil fuels? And how can we move beyond that and get past these ridiculous costs which are being imposed upon us, many people would say manipulated upon us? And then we have to ask the question about these space-time singularities and miniature event horizons and creating them in our own environment. And I still even got back to the question of what films are being produced by Dr. Fred Bell next. We'll start tracking down these subjects one after another and then get you involved next hour. On Coast to Coast AM, my name's Ian Punnett. Well, I'm ready to go. I've got my pyramid hat in hand, and so I'll be ready to sort out some of these questions with Dr. Fred Bell. I'm going to need a little extra pyramid power, I think, to get through these, Dr. Bell.
Yeah, that's okay.
Because I'm having a little trouble with a couple of these concepts, but let's start with the easy ones. The idea that our hormonal structure, our DNA structure, was changing in all of this with all these exhaust fumes that people were breathing.
Well, yeah, what we have is negative and positive electrical precursing energies. When you look at the body is first biochemistry. The basic metabolism is biochemistry, but that's like a sheep. You put vitamins in, you put nutritional things in. If you don't have some kind of a guidance, the nutrition just doesn't know where to go. And so the actual metabolism process of the biochemistry is the electrical field, the ionization and all those kinds of things, ionizing the different molecules. But there's got to be an intelligence. The intelligence is a science of electrical precursation. And that is based on what your environment is, good or bad, whether you drink water, breathe fresh air, you put junk food, meditate, exercise, those things in a 24-hour period, 7 days a week, 365 a year. And over a period of time, it has a there's a bigger frequency that hovers over the body that talks to the DNA. DNA has a tendency to, when you're first born, you're born with 46 base pairs per turn of DNA, 46 strands. But when you take your first breath of oxygen and you cut the umbilical cord, you now have 34 base pairs per turn. So you've lost 25% of your lifespan in your first breath. In this world, by the time you're 18 years old, you have 18 base pairs per turn. And by the time you're 50, if you don't do something, you've got 6 base pairs per turn. So that means that the cell doesn't get a full set of instructions, and that's why your skin as a baby versus 50 years old looks a little different, and the inside of your body is the same way. Plus, when you get past 30 years old, all your vital organs like liver, kidney, spleen shrinks at the rate of 5% every 10 years. So when you're 50 versus 30, your liver is 20% smaller. So we found ways to turn that around and make it go the other way. We use things like human growth hormone and then electrical precursing energy. But when you get out there on the freeway, this process is sped up. You can actually speed up the decomposition process and decomposing, and that's what goes on with freeway driving.
The exhaust fumes getting into your lungs and then breaking down.
Yes. When it goes into your system, 8 minutes of exposure is 24 hours of symptoms. And what happens is, the hormone that structure in the pituitary gland is first affected. It's called vasopressin, which is made up of two amino acids called lysine and arginine. And what happens is this: when you feel euphoric, when you're up in the mountains, you breathe the snow is coming down or the rain is coming through, and you're down at the seashore, vasopressin is secreted by the negative ionization effect of these different stimulus. But when you get out on the freeway, vasopressin is destroyed. Now, a lot of drug companies over in Europe, Sandoz got in on this picture to try to make a change, And they invented a drug called diapid, which was a synthetic lysine and arginine, which people would squirt up in their nose, and you get it by prescription. This would partially alleviate the problem of depression, but what happened over a period of time, it put the pituitary gland in atrophy because it no longer had the motivation to produce vasopressin, so it makes a druggie out of you on the diapid level. So it's not a thing that people haven't recognized in the medical community. But what happens after about 7 years, the changes get so bad that the lysine and arginine are combines with a couple of amino acids that it shouldn't be combining with, producing hormones of anger and rage. So when a person gets a small stimulation of carbon monoxide poisoning, they go into a fit of rage. And it's actually a metabolic problem, and it's pretty hard for them to control. There are ways of getting around that, but that's what happens.
And so it isn't just the idea that you're trying to get somewhere and somebody's in front of you and you feel like the whole world, you know, gets pointed to that person at that time, and they're trying to stop you from, you know, your happiness. And so it's not rage that comes out of that.
No, that's just the trigger.
That's just the trigger. The rage comes out of the metabolic change of...
Over time of a person. It takes about 7 years, right. Yeah, and it affects our work factor, too. For example, this is where we got into the Valium studies back in the 70s. A person driving to work gets out of bed, say in Los Angeles, 6 o'clock in the morning, drives an hour and a half to work, gets to work at 7:30. Okay, they're gassed up pretty good now, carbon monoxide, so they're not going to be affected. They got to start detoxing in their workplace, and who knows if they're working under, you know, these horrible fluorescent lights and whatever else, and bad paint on the walls and all the other stuff. They're going to start detoxing very slowly till around noon. Now, hopefully at noon, when they probably start to function somewhat, they're not going to get in their car and go drive to lunch because 8 more minutes is more poison. They might stay and eat their lunch at their workplace, hopefully it's some kind of decent food. So then they get some work done until 2 or 3 in the afternoon. Then they get back in their cars and drive home. Now they get gassed again. So by the time they get home, they've got a pretty good attitude going. If you know, imagine what these people that are doing these crazy games, what their families are going to experience when they walk in the door and they get home.
Mm.
It's going to be wonderful. I mean, the wife's going to need Valium. The kids will be on drugs just to hide from the dad. And he won't now. He'll probably start drinking or doing something to wind himself down, which even is another poison in the body. And so he probably won't function until 7 or 8 at night when he goes into a stupor and collapses. And that's pretty much our society. No wonder our product is so bad in the national thing. And, you know, talking with those other guys earlier about China taking over, China and some of these other countries are aware of these situations that go on. They have a different way of getting people to work, like to get them to work on trains and stuff. They don't get poisoned. They use electricity to run the trains, and they produce a product much cheaper than we do over here. So the gross national product is the war right now, and not bombs and all this other stuff, and that's how they're taking over our economy, you know?
Well,
yeah.
How can we change, then, these fumes? How can
well,
we change
you,
our...
That's a good question. I worked with a group called Voluntrust over in Hungary. What we did is we put negative ionizers in cars over there. We ran tests. Because negative ionization, the body reproduces cells at the rate of 90 million per second if you're healthy. And so what we found is as soon as they get carbon monoxide, that reproduction cycle is interrupted with. So we put them in negative ionization fields, and what happens is they don't have as many car wrecks. The fatigue levels go down. They function a lot better. They don't have all the seasonal ailments and flus that come around. It was a big, big boost. So I took this idea over to General Motors at the time. Few years back when I was developing ionizers that they use over some of them over at Sharper Image now. And so I went over to General Motors and I said, why don't we put ionizers in automobiles as a part of the American, you know, American way of standard. And like we put them in jet fighters, we put them in our spaceships and Mercedes-Benz on the domestic models puts them in. Why can't we do it? So General Motors says, okay, fine. How much does it cost to put an ionizer in your car? I said, about $20. And they said, we can't do it. I said, why not? Because, you know, it just won't work. There's too much money. They wouldn't spend $20 to put in an ionizer. That's how much they care about the people out there.
Well, I don't know about that, but, I mean, they have – I mean, couldn't attest to how they care about people, but it seems to me that those things are available now
at Sharper
Image, right?
Yeah, they're available. You go buy them. Yeah, exactly. And that nuclear receptor, I don't know if you've got one. We haven't sent you one of those yet. That seems to help, too. And believe it or not, the pyramids you're wearing will also help. I had the California Highway Patrol wearing those for a while.
Come on, they were driving around
with
these
on? Yeah, they were driving around with them on. That's fact.
They were not.
They were.
How could they wear that and then put their hat on?
Because they thought they noticed it. I mean, they don't just do it, you know, you know, obnoxiously, but some of them wore them and they liked them. They could keep you awake. If you ever wear one of those on a long trip, you'll find out real quick how it works.
Well, I will definitely save that for my next long road trip. Now, alternative energies right now, I think, are very much on people's minds because of the way that the pump prices are going. Suddenly, we're going to start averaging $3 a gallon. Who would have thought that? So,
yeah, that's a joke. What's going on now? Let me explain to you about my dad and Henry Ford.
Okay.
My dad worked for Henry Ford. As a matter of fact, when I took my first breath of air on this planet, was the University of Michigan Hospital, and I was being delivered by Henry Ford's personal physician, Norman Miller. In those days, a famous guy like Henry Ford, his doctor was like front page news, like a rock star, believe it or not. That's how crazy we were in those days. Henry Ford hated petroleum companies. He hated the oil industry. I can tell you that with a vengeance. And he wouldn't put gasoline in his cars if you gave him all the tea in China. He had 35 acres of hemp trees on his estate. And he ran everything. And Rudolf Diesel, the same guy that did the diesel engine in Germany, designed everything on hemp oil. All our lamps in this country were running on hemp oil. A hemp tree is not marijuana. A hemp tree produces 4 times the amount of oxygen that a tree does, and it can be recycled 4 times a year. And not only that, the exhaust from the hemp oil in a car produces carbon dioxide and water, so it fixes the greenhouse effect. And Henry Ford had 18 personal vehicles in his estate, and every one of them ran on hemp oil. To put hemp oil into your car right now, all you have to do is change the map settings on a fuel injection and the size of the jets in a carburetor. Nothing major has to be done. It works very well. It will also work in aircraft, which is another subject that we could go into at some time.
No, but hold on a second. I have never heard this about Henry Ford running his personal automobiles on hemp oil.
He did. Look it up. On the internet.
This would have to be processed hemp oil turned into a kind of gas product?
Yeah, he turned it into a gasoline. That's what they do, and it costs a few cents a gallon to set it up, and he had the refinery to do it.
Would we ever have enough agricultural space?
To do America, it's 18,500,000 acres to do all of America. I think we can scrounge up 18 million acres out there. And you rotate the crop 4 times a year. So I think, yeah, we could do it.
Okay. So if we had that, four-season crop then of hemp oil, and we could process that, and then we would be completely divested of our need for foreign oil.
Exactly. Now, why aren't we doing that? Go on the internet and research it, and you're going to get the same results. All over the internet if you go deep enough. Yeah.
I'm fascinated that something that is a plant product could work as well, in that I think they've had, they haven't had all that great success even using corn, using that. I mean, it's good as an additive.
Corn is supported. The hybrid corn is supported by the chemical industry, and all these hybrid corns that they produce, the insects that attack them can only be treated with special chemicals. Normal chemicals doesn't even hurt the insects that eat this corn. The corn is another big scam right now. I don't know if you know that or not.
No, I didn't know this at all.
Yeah, it is.
What do you mean by that?
Well, the corn industry, it's synthetic. It's not real corn anymore, and they don't want these tests. Why use corn when hemp oil is proven? Hemp oil was up until the 30s, was our paper, our constitution. If you make a sail and put it on a ship, it will never rot. I mean, hemp, and even soy products would go away because hemp is can be broken down into simple proteins and digested by the body better than soy products. Hemp is too much of a threat. They don't even want hemp to be imported in this country in the form of clothing. So naturally, when you get into corn, 3M, Monsanto, those companies that make all those chemicals, those hybrids,
right,
for corn, you're getting into an industry here that is very, very guarded. It's almost not quite as much as the tobacco industry, but it's very much protected right now.
Well, I understand
hybrid corn.
I understand the difference between hemp and marijuana, but even if you burned hemp oil in a car, what would the exhaust fumes be?
Carbon dioxide and water. That's it. That's what I just said. No, you wouldn't have a smog device anymore. There goes the smog industry, which is also very corrupt.
Okay. Yeah. And no thought of if you were all in a hemp haze there in traffic that would have any adverse effects on you.
No, because there's no cannabinols and there's no THC products.
All right, because that would definitely change.
Yeah, I mean, sure, a lot of people out there, marijuana supporters, would like that, but
suddenly they wouldn't mind being stuck in a traffic jam. Is what you're saying?
Well, carbon dioxide and water. No, you wouldn't. Right. You wouldn't have. There'd be no. Diesel, for example, produces, I think, 18 horrible poisons. I used to know all of them.
I used to be able to name
all that stuff. Yeah. Well, Rudolf Diesel invented the diesel, ran it on hemp oil. He ran his diesel engines on hemp oil.
I guess that surprised me that anybody that at one time there had been a way to process that and nobody is still. Is there
cheaper
there people
than gasoline?
But aren't people still doing that on like co-op farms or anything like that?
Not around here. They'll get busted for it. It's illegal. Well, offshore, I can see it's probably going to happen. You know, I mean, I'm sure China will do it soon. And they'll probably make cars and sell them all over the world. You know, I mean, somebody's going to do it. But they're too stupid here to do it. I mean, not too stupid, but the political industry.
Yeah, it just would be hard to get people to go along with that.
Yeah, I dare anybody listening out there to challenge me on this and the next show bust me and say it's not possible.
I'm still getting there. Okay. All right. Well,
I'm serious.
I'll watch the email.
I'm an advocate.
We get a lot of email, by the way, before you came. People are asking some questions about you, and I wanted to ask why don't I transition here with a question that came up about something else that you had talked about, that your father had once been involved in some way with the moving of the London Bridge.
Yeah, he brought the London Bridge over, him and C.B. Woods and Robert McCulloch.
It wasn't Robert McCulloch?
Robert McCulloch, yeah, Bob McCulloch. I used to work with him, too, before he died. I knew him very well. He was a chainsaw guy. Yeah.
So what did your father and he and how did it get over here?
Okay. Well, they brought it over. McCulloch at an auction. He wanted a bridge. He was flying over. First of all, you got to go back. McCulloch was making wanted to make outboard motors. He ended up buying Scott Atwater. My dad was his number one development engineer for every project he ever had in those days. So they were up. McCulloch owned LAX, all the land there, and McCulloch was the sixth richest man in 1956 when his Lazy Susan was on the front cover of Life magazine. So he was a big shaker and mover in the 50s. So he went over to Arizona and they were building the Parker Dam and the Havasu was getting bigger, the lake was getting bigger, and he wanted a test area to test his outboard motors. So what happened was he decided to buy all this land in the middle of nowhere and he called it Site 6. And so then he got an idea. You know, the London Bridge is falling down, so he went over and bought this bridge. It was in an auction. He paid $2,660,000 for this bridge, and the $60,000 got added on because during the auction he decided to put his age at the time the bridge will be built, because he was like 50 something. He said he'd probably finish by 60. So and then he won the auction because it was $2,660,000. It cost $3 million to bring the bridge over. My dad then put all the bricks together, numbered 101, 102, and they shipped them all over here to Long Beach. They came into Long Beach, and then they carried them by truck over to Havasu City. They put them in where it was dry. There was just a hotel built there at that one time, and that's all they had. They put the bridge in, and then later on they started putting up condominiums, and that was C.B. Woods. C.B. Woods was a very smart guy from Texas who did all kinds of real estate things. So he decided to combine real estate with the glory of the bridge, and they created Havasu City out of Site 6. And at that time, McCulloch had his own airline, too, and so he used to fly people in and out of up there because there was no real air transportation. And he had his own airport out there, too, I might add.
And then this partly explains then the history of the family genius in that you're also a descendant of Alexander Graham Bell.
Yeah, and Ethan Allen.
And Ethan Allen.
Yeah, my dad's name is Allen from the Allen side of his family, and that was Ethan Allen. And then Bell from the Bell side, we're Scottish.
Right.
And we came from Newbury, England, originally.
Well, somebody wrote me and said his name is Jeff, he's in Canada, and he believes you're a distant relation of his wife's. You're a descendant of Alexander Graham Bell.
Yeah.
His wife is a descendant from Alexander Graham Bell's cousin, Alexander Bell Graham,
That's
what he said.
Yeah,
he said there are two marriages between the two families.
Yeah, I don't doubt it. I've got a picture from our family tree. You know, I've got pictures of Alexander Graham Bell here at the house. I've got them hanging on the wall in there, hanging on the wall area, you know. So he was a direct descendant, and all of us are crazy. Alexander Graham Bell built pyramids. He slept in a pyramid. He was developing a hearing aid, and that's how he ended up with the telephone, because about a week later there were 300 patents down there applied for to get the telephone.
Right.
And he did a lot of this. Both of us designed jet engines. He was working on a type of jet engine. This is a long time ago, you know.
Sure it was.
And he was a great dancer, and he was quite an entertainer. And I mean, this Alexander Graham Bell, he ended up in Canada. And then he also was one of the founders of National Geographic, too.
Hang on there. We'll come right back to this. I want to ask you about the holographic projector. By the way, happy birthday. It was just last week, was it?
Yeah.
Or just the other day?
Yeah.
And And I want to find out all the other stuff that you're up to, because as fast as he can think of a project, Dr. Fred Bell is back at work, just like his famous ancestor. Dr. Fred Bell, author of Rays of Truth, Crystals of Light. You can hook up to him, of course, at coasttocoastam.com online. And I look forward to hooking up with you here on this huge topic, because conceptually I have to understand something you referenced last hour. That is the holographic nature of creation. What do you mean by that, Dr. Bell?
Well, we started to get into it with the wave packets, and I just want to clarify something to the listeners out there. Any one of these subjects that we're covering could be a whole show, just so you know that. I mean, we can go way into it, but it's fun to do this. The holographic projector, right now the government is doing a bunch of studies on DNA, and if they notice that DNA is something that's, you know, like between animals and fixed objects, they're looking at energy fields. And what they're finding out is if you make a change in one, DNA cell, another cell not related to that particular species also seems to somehow or other record a change.
Now, what do you mean by that? That means if you change the DNA of a deer, that
it affects an antelope or an elephant somehow in a very subtle way. And these are very sensitive changes that they're looking at, and they're looking at it on an energy level. But the human body is the same way. In your red blood cell, every time, if you look at the complete blueprint of a red blood cell, every time something in your brain changes, something changes there. So everything is all connected.
Okay,
and
so
that's what the big research is right now.
All right, so how does that inform us on the holographic nature of creation?
Okay,
what's
the holographic nature of creation? Remember we talked about the wave packet, you know?
Right.
And there's thousands of these wave packets. All religions have them. Everybody has them. They're everywhere. If you stand away from these. Oh, and by the way, when you're working within a wave packet in a scalar wave, you're working with an element called karma, law of cause and effect, good and evil, you know, positive, negative, the polarities, all that stuff. In the hologram, none of that exists. The hologram is the divine shape of all creation. And
okay.
So when you want to, and our consciousness is raising now, and we're moving into that space where we can actually look at the actual blueprint of all of creation. With that knowledge, we can then start to change all of creation simultaneously without having to wait for karmic or wave packets or any of those sorts of things. That's the kind of technology that we're working on with the projectors that you see on your website and our website both tonight.
Okay, which I'm fascinated with. So
yeah.
How do we employ a holographic projector?
Well, the way we employ it is we have to get familiar with it. We work with one. There's one that's worn, and there's one that sits in on your desk next to your computer. And all you have to do with it is observe it and think about something near it. Just think about something near it. It will automatically set up an energy field inside of you, and you'll actually feel your thought being processed, and you can actually witness this processing take place with some kind of an outside event that you were thinking about. And I always tell people to use these things, be careful what you think. And it took us about 20 years to develop this thing, and now we've got them in a lot of places, and people that use them, I've got so many references of people that have no idea how they work, but they know they work, they know they do something, and do something very powerful.
And so what will they do? Well, what's the outcome? What will the effect be?
Well, I'll give you an example.
Okay.
Here's an example. I had one of my distributors down here from Canada the other night. I had just given one to an actress up in Los Angeles. I'll just say that her first name is Frances. Let's just leave it at that.
Okay.
I said to him, I'm going to show you something with this projector. I'm going to show you how this works. I'm going to call her right now, and within 5 minutes or 4 minutes, I'm going to have her on the phone. So he's sitting there. It's about 11:14 at night. So I called her and I got her answering machine. And I said, I want you to call me back within 5 minutes. I don't care where you are, what you're doing. About 4 minutes later, the phone rang and she was on the phone. And my distributor is like saying, how did this happen? And I put her on the speakerphone. And I said, Frances, tell me why you called me just now. And she says, well, I'm in an acting class. It goes from 11 to 12 at night, these acting classes. She said at 11:13 or 11:14, my instructor, all of a sudden, normally doesn't stop till 11:30 to take a break, decided he had to go use the restroom or something, called a break. So for some reason, I just went outside and decided to check my cell phone messages, noticing that you had just called 3 minutes earlier. So I decided to call you. So at 11:14, she's on the phone. It was just a series of what you would call coincidences. it doesn't matter what you call it. The fact is, this is what these things do, and it's so many coincidences. It's because it's tied into this hologram, and things like that go on and on and on. I've got a guy back on the East Coast. His first name is Steve. I use him as one of my references. He does healings on people. Now, when he started using this, he's like one of these visionary healers. His visions went through the roof. His patients that come in there with these different ailments are being, you know, things are happening to him so much faster than he's ever seen before. He just like, he actually canceled his vacation to keep playing around with his equipment and his patients. So, and by the way, when we talked about projectors and receptors or anything that we do or anybody does about healing, the body has to heal itself. These things don't heal you. You heal yourself. But we can speed up the process of the healing process within the human body. Here's another way that the projector works. Let's say that your family is prone to getting cancer.
Okay.
A cancer is a karmic thing. It's a hereditary thing. It's a DNA thing. If you subject a person that's prone to getting cancer into the field of one of these things, that element that was hanging on them karmically is now gone. They're not susceptible to cancer anymore. It's gone. And then if they use one of these projector receptors on their body, the pH of the body will change. It'll go alkaline, and it's impossible to get cancer. And I'm not making a medical claim. I'm just saying with an alkaline body, which this will produce, you won't get cancer. And cancer does not grow when your body is in a pH of 6.6 to 7.5. That's exactly where you're going to go.
Can you measure that yourself before and after?
Yes, you can. You can measure this stuff. As a matter of fact, in my book, when you get further down, and you've read a lot, I might add, because of what you said, and you've only had that a few hours, there's a thing in there I'm developing right now worldwide called the X1 Healing Machine.
Right.
The prototype that we're getting ready to build uses sound-like frequency, and we use what we call holographic sound, sound that penetrates. You can't tell where it's coming from. And we measure the body with biofeedback equipment. We use more therapy equipment coming from Germany and a lot of other types of equipment. We look at the galvanic skin response. We look at the response of occipital and parietal lobes, the electrical frequencies of the brain. We look at the specific gravity changes on the skin, the surface tension of the skin. We look at all of these things before and after. We use these devices before and after. We measure these things in a computer. We're building a database now, and we're going to be putting these X1 healing machines out on leases all over the world. That's what some of the stuff that we're developing at Paradigm right now. And the projector is a big part of it. So we're not just, you know, there's a website called blog, bloginservice.com, which is accessible off of ours. On that website, I am posting all of my military, my Department of Defense credentials are all going up there now because I made some pretty outrageous claims on these shows over many years.
Right.
Now I'm posting where you'll see where I work with Lockheed Skunk Works. You'll see paper about that. You'll see all that all documented on the website. Because now we're going in a very bold direction. We're bringing out products that are completely beyond belief to anything this planet has ever seen, except when the government, the government would come in and smash things up and hide them. We're developing stuff all over the world simultaneously as we do this show, and we're bringing all this stuff out. I'm writing another book now called The Inside Track that'll be out next spring. That'll be more along the hologram than the one you've got now. Deals up to scalar waves and some of those space-time singularity things you were going to talk about.
Right.
I'm taking this a whole other level, and that's also why I'm in the film industry, because we're working on some documentaries right now to bring all this out, and people are going to say, well, these guys came out of nowhere, but not really. We've been doing the Art Bell Show for 7 or 8 years.
Of course,
talking to Ian about it, and he knew all about it. Where were you?
Well, I look forward to being able to say that someday.
Yeah.
Let me ask you, though, about the Department of Defense thing. This is something that comes up a lot on Coast to Coast.
Yeah.
Because there's kind of a counterintuitive, or at least it's – I don't know if it's counterintuitive, but it's at least simultaneously, it seems like a guest will be speaking about the government, the difficulties of the government, and at the same time working with it or talking about peace and working toward – raising global consciousness, and then also helping the Department of Defense. How do you reconcile those two things?
Well, the way I reconciled it, sometimes I was considered a rogue, and sometimes I was considered a benefit. And when I years ago, when you see some of the stuff on there, I was involved in a big thing, a big dispute, and that's all posted, by the way. It's all documented about Roger Chaffee and White and Grissom died on the Cape down there,
right?
The Apollo 1. when that happened, I was involved in that. I tried to stop that before it happened. We had 1,407 tests, wiring problems we found on that bird after it blew up. And so I got into a big controversy. But what I did at that time, you'll see all the electronic news articles and magazines that I was in back in those days, because I was always high profile. You have to build a profile around yourself to protect yourself. I've always done that. I always make sure that millions of people know who I am and what I'm doing, and I've been doing that most of my life. So you have to develop a profile so that gives you some kind of sanction.
Yeah.
The second thing is you've got to know stuff. I mean, you know, obviously when I went out and visited 3,000 companies, which is also documented on that website, I had to know something, and I had to be of some sort of a benefit.
Sure.
And I was, because I had training in quantitative and qualitative measurements. And anybody that's doing any kind of an experiment, whether it be biofeedback, whether it be a strain gauge on a wing test in a wind tunnel, or whether it be a lunar landing experiment in a cryogenic chamber, I was there. I was your person, and I did that kind of stuff. And I documented it, and I kept all my documents.
Well, I get that. I guess what I'm saying is maybe morally then, maybe I'll be more specific, that it seems like you're talking about peace in one sense and raising global consciousness and advancing, you know, a kind of a planetary responsibility for what's happening in the world and how our government can sometimes not be working in our best interest, and then also working for the Department of Defense.
Okay, well, here's another example. Let's just say I have friends in intelligence.
Okay.
Okay, when George Tenet fell on his sword for Bush, right?
Right.
A lot of really good people that I knew left the intelligence community. They left. And these are people that had experience with extraterrestrials. Some of them, they would consult with me after they had the experience. These people had families like we do. And they were concerned. There's a human factor in intelligence, just like there is outside of it. But when political aversion and corruption get so great, then there's mass exoduses. And that's what happened then. Up until that point, you know, I was doing quite a bit of work with what I thought people that were involved in the government, and they had good heart chakra, good heart root causes. That's the kind of people I work with. Back a long time ago in the 60s when I worked in them, and back in the 50s when I was first indoctrinated as a kid, I didn't know so much about good and bad and who was right and who was wrong, and I don't think because the Cold War was going on it really mattered that much. But as time went on and I saw these cover-ups, It really got to me. But on the same hand, I became a well-known Pleiadian contactee, and I brought some amazing science out, and some of that's posted up on another website. Some of it's on my website. And so some of the inventions that I had come up with and some of the designs that I used were beyond, you know, you just couldn't say there wasn't something to this. So that gave me credibility. And in the old days of exchange, there'd be 50% BS and there'd be 50%, you know, stuff. They want to know what about contact. I'd say so-and-so site, this installation is going to be visited by ETs and blah, blah, blah. And they'd be there. And that would kind of stir them up, you know.
Have they ever had any direct contact that you know of?
The government?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, where...
Yeah, yeah, lots and lots and lots of it.
Sit down, interview, running a tape recorder, kind of...
So they don't... Well, yeah, but they aren't going to release any of that kind of stuff. This started back with Roswell. That Roswell crash, I've got that documented on there with the radar that I was working on. I was developing the Alamogordo Valley in Santa Fe, in that area, that brought those ships down. I got that on the website. And that was the first crashes they had, you know. The first one was 1951. Dr. Mendoza from Johns Hopkins University was interrogating one of the three survivors of Roswell, and they call that's where the term extraterrestrial biological entity EB was coined. I mean, you can go back to there if you want to start getting reference material, and then we can come forward. One of my friends was at White Wright Patterson back in mid 80s, and they had underground at Wright Pat in Dayton, Ohio. There was three different groups of aliens there working. And then when my friend Margaret Habsburg of the Habsburg fame of Europe, her husband was working with four grays out at Sandia Labs when she lived out there with a friend of mine, Anthony James, Sir Anthony James, who was knighted by the Queen of England, who was one of my best friends. They were working with grays. That's the theta reticulans.
Working with them meaning what? I mean, like going in, punching a clock?
Propulsion systems and weapon systems.
And they would just be there... Like anybody else.
Yeah, when Margaret's husband died, realize Margaret Habsburg owns 60% of Europe. You know, there's the Habsburg, the Bilderbergers, the Vanderbilt, the Rockefellers. These are the richest families in the world. They're trillionaires. And she was scared to death, because her husband was working on this stuff. They were living. They had the NSA as their guards, and they had a 40-acre compound inside the Sandia Labs, proving grounds, and that's where they lived, and they did all these experiments over there. This goes on. Also, we got a lot of stuff going underground. I don't know if you noticed, they're closing all the surface bases now, and everybody's going underground because of the problem with the atmosphere.
Well, I want to hear more about that too, but yeah. I back up. It's a really mundane question, but when working with these EVs or working
extraterrestrial biological entities,
right? Working with them on a day to day basis, you mean they have like a dorm for them? Do they have houses?
Yeah,
they have
facilities for them. Of course they do. Yeah,
and are they human like facilities?
Well,
are they more like what they experienced on their home planet?
They're environmental. They're environmentally comfortable for the different people that they work with.
So
and most of them are underground for obvious reasons. They don't want to be detected by satellite from space.
So atmosphere, I mean, regular oxygen?
In our atmosphere, some of them, this reptilian thing that they had that I never saw, but one of my friends saw it in intelligence, he said he had to wear a suit all the time. He had some kind of a methane suit that he wore. He had to have the addition of methane, to breathe. He couldn't breathe the oxygen. It didn't work too well for him.
All right. So
I never met him, but this is just this hearsay. Most I'm familiar with is the Greys. And a few of the Nordic types, the Pleiadian types.
Okay. Did they wear clothes?
Yeah. They wear loose-fitting clothes.
Like of their own type, or did they adapt to laboratory wear?
No. They wore their own clothes.
Okay.
They're just skin-tight little things, like, what do you call that stuff that people on bicycles all over the place ride?
Right.
Yeah, that kind of stuff, mostly.
Okay.
Yeah.
And then did they speak English then, or did they communicate telepathically?
I had one experience with one Gray. His name was Gofty Lofty. And the Grays speak. I mean, if you imagine making this, how we talk when we exhale, we have a tendency to speak. If you try to inhale and speak, you'll make these funny sounds. That's kind of what they do. They have a very high-frequency pitched sound that they make when they communicate, but normally they commute telepathically quite well. They can project thoughts right into your brain. And that's been my experience. That's pretty much how they work. The Pleiadians, they don't work with the government because they don't like the government. But they have been captured by the government, and they can speak English. They speak several languages. They can adapt to a language. The Pleiadian language is more like Sanskrit, and Sanskrit is the Tibetan language. It was brought here 26,000 years ago by what's called the Rishis and the Vedas. And the Rishis came from the Pleiades, so their language is based on phonic sounds of nature, like water, running, wind blowing, and those kinds of things. So the languages vary depending on the species. The Grays are considered a 6-billion-year-old evolved insect in the fact that they don't have a soul like we do. They have group hive consciousness. So they have a different, they have an insect-type communication, but it is telepathic. It's a little bit painful for some people.
What do you mean?
Well, I had a couple of experiences with them as a contactee and with a Gray directly, and it was just uncomfortable for me. I really didn't get into it. I like Pleiadians much better.
Well, I'm fascinated by that. So can I ask you, just when we come back, to explain why that was painful?
Sure.
And then I promise you I want to get back to all the other places where we were going.
Wherever you want to go. I love talking to you. You're great. You're very knowledgeable.
Well, I'm curious more than knowledgeable, but I certainly want to explore where you're going to take us with miniature event horizons and space-time singularities, too. But we'll just have to do that right after our discussion about why it was painful to work with the Grays, with a guy who should know, Dr. Fred Bell. Dr. Fred Bell, we just left off. We were talking about working with the Grays and that there are several installations around the country, mostly underground, where on a daily basis, kind of a, we could even say a workaday basis, there are Grays that just are punching a clock, getting the job done with humans.
I kind of like punching the clock. I don't know if they do that, but that's a good analogy.
Yeah. Would they socialize?
No.
Okay.
No, they don't socialize. There was a bunch of them up at Dulce, New Mexico, in Archuleta Mesa up there, and in the Jicarilla Apaches. I did a couple of TV specials up there and on them, and I got to know the Indians quite well, and I had an encounter with them one night in one of their ships, but they were more likely to abduct people if they could get away with it. That was one of the big things the government tried to have. They got the abduction stuff got out of hand there for a while, and the implanting that was going on.
Why do they like to abduct?
Well, it's a bigger picture. It has to do, the way they were using, the technology we're using has to do with the removal of the constitutional freedoms of the average American. And they were doing that by putting implants in people and then causing them to do crazy things and then legislating away our freedoms by the terrorist acts that they committed. For example, the shooting in 1984 in Texas by what's his name, Whitney,
the guy in the clock tower.
Yeah, the clock tower. He was implanted. He was found to have two implants. It was even ABC even made a movie out of it at one point. And what happens? They began legislating away the freedom of different kinds of weapons, and it just goes on and on and on. And so these implants are calculated. They're put in. I remember working with a lot of radiology labs all around the country, and they're saying, I don't know where these little pieces of objects are coming, but we're sure pulling them out of a lot of people's heads in different parts of their body. So that whole program was instituted probably in the late 70s, early 80s.
So what's in it for them?
What, the Greys?
Yeah.
Sanctuary. They're coming. Their worlds, I guess, are collapsing, and they need to move out and colonize other areas. And according to the Pleiadians, they've been... They're energy scavengers anyway. That's why when you ask, do I like to communicate with them? No, because my training with telepathy started at the University of Michigan when I was working with Stephen Eberbaugh back in the 60s, actually late 50s, which that was the beginning of that MK Ultra stuff. And I was trained into a way of communicating telepathically that was done on the basic harmony of the human aura and the resonant frequencies between two personalities. And they're, because they're non-resonant to humans, and they have a completely different metabolic system. Their frequencies, their etheric frequencies and their oral frequencies they emanate are very unpleasant. It's like blowing a whistle into a phone when somebody's on the other end. It hurts your ear. And so that was the kind of thing. So for me, it wasn't very pleasant. So I kind of shied away from them. But they were always aware of me because of what I do and what I've done over the years. So they were always kind of like pests.
What do you mean, pest meaning?
Well, they tried to do some pretty negative things to me. They tried to kill me at one point.
How did they do that?
Or
better yet, how did they fail at doing that?
Well, they almost got away with it. The house I live in now in Laguna Beach, I was gone one day, and the neighbors, which are very straight people, I'm the only crazy one in this neighborhood, well, the craziest in the neighborhood, said that an object, a large disc, came down over my house in my absence. This is more than one neighbor. And dropped a bunch of what looked like tinfoil on the house. And when I came back from a one-week trip, when I started going in the house, I was attacked by some kind of a strange virus in all the people that were staying with me at the time, where we almost died from it. And so I had it, at first I had to treat it, you know, homeopathically, and then I had to treat it with some kind of strange bacterial infection set in. And I don't normally get sick, and this is, it just about wiped me out. And a friend of mine was visiting from Hawaii. It hit him, and then I was married at the time. It hit my wife. It just got us all, you know. And based on what the – and the other time we were out in Dulce, New Mexico, but this was a –
Hold on, yes, doctor.
Yeah.
Why not just vaporize you? I mean, why not just –
I don't know. I don't think that's – I think that, you know, when you do this work like I do, that there are other forces that carry a large stick around, and I think they have a problem with it. I think they subtly try to do things. But I don't think they can get away with it. And I do know that this force, it's like the protective force that I have around me, and probably others do the type of things that I do. If you go against that force, it will turn on you. So, I mean, there is a protective entity that we all have if we develop it and become aware of it. But I think we become more aware of it as we get into more and more different types of work that make our work efforts affected, you know, into more of humanity. And I know that some of my work is kind of getting around town, you might say.
Well, around town, you're being metaphoric for the universe then?
Well, all over the world, you know, okay. We're helping people now.
All right, but so yeah. Who would these other people, would it be the Pleiadians that would be saying,
Pleiadians,
hey, look, if you touch him, we're going to come after you?
No, the Pleiadians would be more protective on my side, I would say.
Right, that's what I mean. So they would be threatening, the Greys would be standing back for fear that if they came and they just gave you one shot of some ray or something, that then they would have to be having to deal with the Pleiadians?
Yeah, I think they'd have a bigger problem on their hands. And the other thing is, I think that the Pleiadians allowed some of this Grey activity to give me a little bit of a taste of what it's like to keep me up, my chops up.
Okay.
Well, I think that was loud. I mean, I really do. And my first experience with a gray was when I was 6 years old living on Claremont Avenue in Buffalo, New York. So, I mean, I had an experience when I was very young, and I didn't know anything about Pleiadians or anything else at that point in time, but I just had that one experience.
And that one experience was an abduction?
No, it wasn't an abduction. It came into my room and it where I was living, and it walked around and it spoke to me over a period of two or three evenings with these strange sounds, and his name was Gawky Locky. It left a name that I, at 6 years old, I still remember it. It was that vivid of an experience.
I'm going to have to put my pyramid hat back on. Okay. I know you said that name before. Could you say it a little slower?
Gawky Locky is his name.
And whatever happened to him?
I don't know. After that one experience over two or three evenings, I never ever heard or saw from him again. And I never heard from any gray up until about, early 80s. Then I had an experience with them again, and it was a contact experience. And that's when I had this unpleasant feeling that I was telling you about earlier in the show.
Very interesting. Very interesting. Well,
yeah.
I know that it took us away from where you were heading with that, and I don't want to stop. I want to let you go back to that, but I also want to make sure that we have enough time to roll over this idea about what we can do with our own miniature event horizons, okay, when we come back. And I think you're the perfect guy to ask a question of that I know I've been thinking about it. I don't have any idea whether you've ever reflected on this, but I all week long I've been bugged by this one particular very normal human phenomenon, and I'll ask you about it coming up next and just see where you go with that. Dr. Fred Bell next on Coast to Coast AM. My name's Ian Punnett. A lot of what we've talked about tonight is in the book Rays of Truth, Crystals of Light. Dr. Fred Bell is also working on a new book coming up. When will that one be out?
Hopefully, first of the year, probably March, somewhere around in there. I'm always late on my books to procrastinate.
I know you'll be back on Coast to Coast when that's out, if not before.
If you let me back on, I like doing the show with you. I've never done this before, and I think you're a lot of fun.
Well, thank you. I appreciate your willingness to be both candid and also to help wonder with us about some of the things which you might take for granted. I mean, you say them in a way that sounds, you know, kind of almost kind of old hat. But for us, I mean, at least for me anyway, I'm pretty wide-eyed about
this.
Yeah,
I know you are, and it's okay. And you got me talking about ETs, which I wasn't planning on doing tonight, but I don't mind it. I've always been quiet about that. I don't run around, talking about that. Of course, you know, we've got a huge audience here, obviously, but and you've kind of got me into the corner with it, but I don't mind.
Well,
I will talk about this stuff.
Well, I hope it's not a corner. I mean, it's so interesting because you kind of toss it off. And it's just so riveting. I mean,
here's the deal with that. Truth is the beginning, truth is the middle, and the end. And time is here. And I guarantee you, in the next few years, all this stuff will come out. It's all coming out now, what I'm telling you tonight, and people will know it to be true. And I'll put my name, reputation, if I've got one, on what I'm saying. It really will happen. And we're bringing it out now, and it's coming from all over the world. And I know I say some far-out things, but I have lived a far-out life. And if you know anybody that's worked with me or been around me, they'll tell you that it's amazing what goes on. I don't know that I'm the cause of it, but I seem to be in the middle of it all the time.
Well, that's interesting, and I appreciate that self-reflection on how you say, you know, you say a lot of far-out things, but you've had a far-out life. Certainly, you've done a lot of very interesting things. It goes back to that initial question of if you're at a party, how do you describe yourself? How do you describe what you do?
I try not to. I try to go in the corner and hide.
Because?
Because I'm basically kind of an introvert when I'm by myself. I like to be, you know, out here and do this show, but then when I'm not, I like to do my research, and I'm reading all the time, and I only sleep a few hours a night, and I don't know how to describe it. I just tell people I'm a student. I don't want to be a professor, and I've seen people try to become teachers, and they usually fail at it at some point. So I'm just a student. I'm just learning. You know, I'm just from sort of like from Missouri, and just show me something. But I've been learning a lot lately, you know.
Well, show us about miniature event horizons and space-time singularities and how we can create them in our own environment.
Yeah, I will. Now, was that your question you were reflecting on? You said you had a question before we went on break there.
No, it's totally different from that.
Okay. That's
do you want me to run that by you now? And
when do you want to do it?
I'll do it right now.
Okay, what is it?
I have become intrigued by the dynamics of intuition.
Right, I understand.
Why do and I read a quote earlier this week from Albert Einstein about it, and he said the one thing of value he felt was intuition.
Right.
How does it work?
Okay, intuition, there's seven levels of consciousness, all right?
Yeah.
The intuition, the intuitive factor, is absorbing all of them simultaneously, knowing your own reference within that assimilation. It's like going in. It's like pretending that we're inside of the whole universe is like an archetype, and we're inside of a greater being, greater than us, and we're moving along in the bloodstream of this greater being. And one day, as we go through the bloodstream, we're suddenly behind the eyes of this greater being, and we can see through his eyes. And so intuition is like knowing that we're in this bloodstream of this greater being, and one day we're going to look out through his eyes. We know there's something beyond and bigger than what we are. And it's also about as you get older in life, you are around lots and lots of people, and you start to sense certain things in their actions, and you start to sense the outcome. And pretty soon you've got so much sensation going by other people's actions and your views on them and predictability, and you actually see the outcome as to be what you predicted it might be.
And that's so
that opens the door. That opens the door to a self-confidence. And then it goes to the DNA level. And that door opens, there is a rush of information, because in the perfect world, intuition is the way of life. It's the way of thoughts. You know, in Tibetans and in martial arts both, they teach you the mind is the slayer of the real. You got to shut your brain down and not think. Thinking is useless. You got to go with the feeling. Inside the feeling in the solar plexus, there's gray matter on the diaphragm, just like we have in the brain. And the thyroid gland is the doorway between the two. And you start breathing and you start meditating, thinking about nothing. And the intuition grows and grows, because the intuition is really something that reinforces our ignorance.
Well,
it takes it away. It gives us knowledge.
You tie in that with the idea of, if I was following you there, of kind of going with your gut, that there's a kind of intuitive feeling that you actually get physically,
right,
that says this is a good thing or this is a bad thing, or why don't you do this?
Yeah, go with that. Nobody does. And they say, oh, I wish I had of.
Right.
Because we're so conditioned not to.
Well, you know, and yet intuition is something, and I think we're hitting on the intuition in two different contexts. One is intuition as an intuitive way of living, of trying to see past the seemingly coherent and look for the seemingly incoherent and try to tap into that.
Exactly.
And not always be driven by our senses.
Exactly.
But then there's that other type of intuition, which I'm also really into, which is I get these thoughts all the time, and they seem to make absolutely no sense. Things I should do, things I ought to check, people I ought to call. And when I do, almost always, and I don't know what the, you know, batting average is, but somewhere in the 900s, it would seem, there seems to have been a reason for that all along, and
exactly,
it came entirely outside of myself.
Exactly, and that's what people have to learn to do. If this higher force, we could call it God, whatever, you know, if we get up in the morning, we plan out what we're going to do, and the higher force, the higher will is going to be done. The higher force will laugh at our program every day. And so eventually you give up. I give up on my program a long time ago. People wonder how come I do so much, because I'm spontaneous on everything. You know, in the old days I used to plan, you know, to start a company. I started many of them. I'd do a projection, sales projection, forecast, all of that. Investors put money in, get your money back at this point in time, 9 months from now, this much money. Forget all that stuff. I threw that out the window. It doesn't work anymore. And when you get greater into the work, greater into your beingness for being here, you're here for a reason. You're talking to millions of people for a reason, because you have a message, and you're going to deliver that message through people like myself and other people, and that's what you're here for. So you're coming into your divine work now, and when that happens, you know, then the intuition is the big deal. I mean, you got to go with it, because you can't fight it, because it won't go away.
You know, and yet somehow it seems like that sort of thing is quantifiable, almost like you could do research on that, almost like there should be studies done, that it's such a common experience that people seem to feel intuitive thoughts as even at levels, like you said, where they heard them, they noted them, they remembered them, but they didn't act on them, so that later on when something happens, they go back and they say, oh, you know, I could have had a V8. I mean, they just kind of have that moment of like, darn it, I wish I'd done differently. And yet nobody seems to be really doing a lot of research in that.
I know they don't, but there is we've done a lot of research in it, and we've developed devices to enhance that. That's the stuff that I do. What you're talking about is what I like to do, and I've been doing that. I've been using myself as a laboratory, and I've got others. And you know, children have an intuition that are pretty good when they're very young, like a little innocent child, 4 years old, says mommy, blah blah blah. And like embarrasses the hell out of because they've just brought a truth out about somebody that's standing in front of them, and they just saw right through their facade, and it's a child, the innocence of a child. You know, we should keep that innocence, and we would have a much better life. But we have a tendency to go in denial and cover it up. So what you're doing with intuition is you're coming out of denial, and you're looking into other people's denial, and when you see the pattern of it, then you intuitively know why they're denying it, and that gives you a truth. So there's just different approaches to the truth.
And yet, if you walked around all day long and you lived in your intuition, I think you would accomplish more.
You would.
And yet people's rational minds talk them out of
exactly
following their intuitive thoughts.
I know. That's because they're thinking. Don't think. Act. Feel and act. Feel and act. That's what you have to do.
Yeah. Well, see, and earlier in the week, as soon as Lisa Lyon mentioned that you would be the guest, I had an intuitive sense that we would have to be talking about intuition. I thought, I haven't even looked at what he's been working up to lately, but I bet you, of all the people I'll talk to this week, you would be the one person I could ask about that, and you'd have something to say. So thank you for that.
Well, I hope I'm making some sense here for you. I'm just doing the best I can.
No, so. You know what? You're hitting on two things there, and I really appreciate it. You're a great conversation partner on that, and I would love to see more on that. And I appreciate your candor on talking about something which ordinarily you don't go out of your way to talk about, and that's the idea of working with Grazer or those
experiences.
Well, that's
how I do some of my stuff. I've surrendered to that for a long time, you know. You know, like Steven Seagal, when they that for martial arts, Aikido,
right.
I studied that for a while. That's up close and front and personal. That's not a karate type thing where you stand back and calculate what the person's doing. You get right in their face, somebody way bigger than you, and you manipulate their energy against them when they come after you. And it's all intuition. It's an intuitional form of martial arts. And the first thing they do is tell you to get rid of your mind, trash it, you know. And that's how it works. And when you get – what are you doing in a confrontation? When you're dealing with people you don't know everywhere, you're dealing with their energy. So the intuition needs to come forward because that's how you deal with their their energy. Open your intuitive senses and go with it. Just try it for a day because that's a big discipline to shut your brain off and just go out and intuitively go through one day. Everybody out there listening should try it.
For one day.
Yeah, for one day.
And then email us with the results.
Yeah, there you go.
I would love that. I think they should.
Yeah.
Just do it for one day. Just keep going with every single thought, no matter how crazy that thought seems at that moment. Go with it. If it says, you know, write somebody a note, if it says stop into this store, if it says bend down and pick up that penny, no matter what it is.
Exactly.
Just go with that thought for an entire day and then see where that day takes you as compared to the usual day in which you just kind of go through and dismiss those thoughts.
Yeah, you don't want to do that because people don't do that, and you don't want to pick this thing up because somebody might think you're crazy and blah, blah, blah. Throw all that stuff out.
Okay, try that for one day.
Yeah.
Right now, it's more than just it's my rational mind says, in the 25 seconds we have left, we cannot talk about miniature event horizons and space-time singularities. But I will open up the phones coming up in this final hour, and I look forward to hearing how other people will hook into the work of Dr. Fred Bell on the way next. And our guest, Dr. Fred Bell, the author of many books, including the bestseller recently, Rays of Truth, Crystals of Light, former NASA scientist and a man who is been involved in so many projects that it'd be difficult to go over all of them now. Although it doesn't mention that you've ever had anything to do with sports.
I'm a figure skater. I used to be.
Get out!
No, I'm serious. I still have. You know, I haven't had a time lately to do that, but I like ice skating. That's what I like to do.
Okay.
And I also race motorcycles and cars. I won two world championships in funny cars. What? I own two funny cars. I actually own one funny car now.
What years did you win championships?
65 and 66 at Lions Drag Strip, Long Beach, California. I still have the trophies.
Now, that's back in the nitro burning days.
Yeah, we ran nitro, yeah.
Yeah.
Nitro methane.
That's back in, like, Shirley Cha-Cha Muldani.
I met Shirley, yeah. She was just starting out. Yeah, Don Perdone, the Snake.
The Snake? Mine,
yeah.
The Snake and the Mongoose?
Yeah, I know Tom. He lived over in Palos Verdes. Aiden Prophet. By the way, before we get into that, I want to tell you something. I want to give you what's called a silver power dome for your intuition thing.
Okay.
And then sometime after you've tried that out for a week or two, it's a special pyramid, not like the one you got. It's made out of titanium and precious metals. Then you can call me or email me, and I'll explain to you how it works once you find out what it does. But it will enhance your intuition tremendously.
I look forward to that, and I appreciate that. I'll take whatever tips I can get.
And one other thing, I got to get this in before I don't get shot. I want to say hi to Ariel and all the people out at Wisconsin tonight.
Of course, and Minnesota.
Okay, in Minnesota.
And all of her, it's a gaggle, and they're here, and they're all they get together regularly, and I pass it along to them too.
Oh, good.
All right, so then guidance here for people on where you want these calls to go. Any particular place?
Oh, yeah. And we will have Verizon to handle them, and don't give up. We get back to everybody. We get 400 or 500 calls behind. It's 1-800-729-2603. That's 1-800-729-2603. We'll get back to you. We never can handle the calls at once, but we get back to everybody, and I'll talk to a lot of people myself as the calls get weeded out, and it's necessary for me to do that. I would like to talk to everybody anyway, but I can't, obviously.
Well, let's see how many we can get. Coming up, we'll ask to keep the questions short so Dr. Fred Bell has time for the answers. You can find out more about Pyradyne.com by looking up to coasttocoastam.com, too, and we'll take email as well. And we'll get it all started next on Coast to Coast AM. My name's Ian Punnett. Well, I put aside my questions for now so that you can get in on Coast to Coast AM, like Claire, west of the Rockies, for Dr. Fred Bell. Claire?
Yeah.
Go ahead.
All right. I just wanted to hear you expound upon the John Titor phenomena. And do you know who created this John Titor phenomena?
I'm not even familiar with it.
Okay.
John Titor phenomena?
Yeah, no.
The time traveler?
No, I've done a lot in time travel. There's been so many people that have discussed it. I'm not familiar with his work. I'm familiar with work that I've done and several other people, but I'm not familiar with his work. Is there some high point that you want to have a question answered?
Well, he came on the Internet in the early part of this century.
Yeah.
And made contact, and he was from the future.
Right.
And then he, and his apparatus, he explained it all, et cetera. And I didn't know if you had gotten into his apparatus and what he was doing.
No, I hadn't, but I developed something called the T1 Time Travel Transposer, which is in my book. And some of the information's over on that website, other website, blogandservice.com.
Thank you, Claire. Tell me about your time travel. It is a whole section of your book, and you actually, in a couple of different ways, you talk about time travel.
Right.
Is that something that that you do a lot of?
No, I don't do it a lot. Let me explain to you really quickly here. What we did is I got the idea when I was working at the University of Michigan and when we were observing the half-life of particles. In other words, when you accelerate particles up to the speed of light, they'd collide with something and we would get reverse time out of that. So what I did is I developed a device whereby you would go inside of it physically and it would speed up the electron-proton relationship in every single cell in your body, taking you and your mind and your brain and all your physiological parts and your mental parts out of this giant web that we're caught in, because we're all synchronized by all our bioclocks on one level are synchronized together. So this device allows you to isolate yourself and move forward by speeding up this process. What I ended up doing is going slightly in the future, a little bit in milliseconds, are actually microseconds. And what I found out, which probably everybody knows anyway, is there is no future. There's only a series of probabilities. And so the whole concept of be here now made a lot of sense, and it was a very disorienting process because I basically went into a black void inside of this machine. When I looked out, it had a window in it, and there's a picture of it on that website. And when I looked out of the window, I saw a car, but it was frozen because I was moving forward. I was accelerating forward. The car, it was at night. The car headlights were shining on the street ahead of it, and you could actually see the individual spot, like photons, individual photons, as the headlights hit the street. So everything was like frozen. Then I sped the process up a little bit more, and everything went black, and I was in a black void, and there was nothing there, because there's absolutely nothing beyond where we are at this very moment in time, anywhere in the universe. We're all synchronized together, believe it or not. The future is a series of possibilities and can be experienced by astral situations, because the astral plane precedes the physical plane. And the device that's explained how it works, it's all in the book. And it's pretty interesting. It's an intricate device, but it works on the theory of how we, you know, do atom smashing in laboratories.
Let's do Nick, first-time caller line for Dr. Fred Bell on Coast to Coast AM. Nick?
Hi.
Hi.
Quick question. We're talking about time travel here. And what is your disposition on George Bush's new bill about daylight savings? Is that going to mess up?
I've never believed in daylight savings because it I don't know what daylight. I don't know his bill, but I'll tell you this: daylight savings, I hate it. Our biological clocks are based on the routine of what time we get up in the morning and what time we go to bed at night, and our biosystems in the human body adapt to the natural things in nature, just like animals do. You don't see horses or cows going on daylight savings time, and I feel that when you disorient somebody by pushing their time forward or backward, it's a psychological control process that the government instituted, and I'm totally against it.
That's great. Yeah.
Thank you, Nick. Say what you like. I don't know if you caught the news story, but President Bush threw out the first pitch at a Little League game today.
Yeah.
And at least he could get it all the way from the mound. You know?
Yeah, that's pretty good.
You know, I mean, his father had a problem with that. Always shorting it, throwing it to home plate.
So I bet Bill Clinton could still do it.
It's nice to see a president who can make it all the way to home plate.
Yeah.
All right, let's go. Mike, east of the Rockies on Coast to Coast AM for Dr. Fred.
Yeah.
Mike?
I got a hard one.
Go ahead.
I hope that's
a question you have in mind. Yes, go ahead.
How long did you take to write his book?
How long did it take to write my book?
Yes.
Well, in physical time, 10 years. In many lifetimes, probably, to get it straight. But it took, the last book is 10 years. It took, this new one has probably taken 2. I've got it
that's
down.
By the way, the
book weighs 5 pounds, and it's got 400 illustrations. It's not. We call it the telephone book. So the next book's not going to have any pictures in it.
Okay.
Yeah, I'm going to do it. I figured I can do it descriptively this time without all the pictures.
Thank you, Mike. Let's go,
yeah,
Peter.
Great question, Mike.
Peter on the international line for Dr. Fred Bell. Peter?
Dr. Bell.
Hi.
I just wanted to ask you a question about how you and your puny human minds came up with the concept of calling us the Grays.
Why do we call the Grays the Grays?
I'm sorry, is this the intergalactic line? Or is this the... Okay, thank you, Peter. Hey, let's go to Ed, wildcard line on Coast to Coast AM for Dr. Fred Bell. Ed?
How you doing, Ian?
All right, go ahead.
Good job. Hi, Dr. Bell.
Hi, how are you doing?
Good, and yourself? I have a question about the Pleiadians, whether they're going to be coming to intercede
I can answer that question. The Andromedans, the Pleiadian lives about 1,500 years in its life, and they are very much sensitive to karmic forces, because when you live that long, you have your immune system is a little different than ours. They can only go so far with us. They taught us a lot of stuff. We've got to execute now. The Andromedans work on the hologram, and the Andromedans are what we call the divine intervening forces that it talks about in the Book of Revelation, if you want to even go that way with it. And so the Andromedans are the ones to watch for. They're male-female, sort of, they're in one body, whereas the Pleiadians were sexual like we are. They're a little bit different. They have a Castilian look as future contactees come up and describe them. They're more like a Castilian look versus a Nordic look. But no, the Pleiadians are fading back because their work is done now.
What was their work that was finished?
Their work, they work with myself, people at Motor, a lot of companies. They helped develop the transistor. They did all kinds of stuff in the computer areas. They did all kinds of stuff with me in life sciences, the areas that I work in. They did a lot. They did work in horticulture. The Pleiadians, they believe to be next to God is to be next to nature. They've done a huge amount in horticulture, and they work with contactees all over the world. Most of them don't get up and talk about it. They just did their work.
But what's their what's the work that's finished? I'm done with the horticulture, done with the transistor?
What's finished now is they put enough seeds in our society, in our technology, and the things that we do that they can't be effective anymore. We have to now pick up the reins and do, and use what we were given to take it to the next level. And that's what I'm trying to say.
What chance do we have against the Andromedans?
The Andromedans are for us. They help us.
Okay.
But they don't have a karmic problem. They don't care about karma. It doesn't work for them. They will fix things, but they will allow us to call out our own species, which we're doing. I mean, look at people driving on cell phones. Is there anybody home? Hello. I mean, do people use turn signals in their cars anymore? I don't think so. You got to use your intuition. You know?
It depends what state you're in. Some states are better
on turn. Where do they use them? I want to go there.
We use them a lot here in the Midwest. We're much more turn
them down there still.
Yeah. Now, I'm not saying they don't turn on their turn signal just before they cut you off and jump in traffic, but at least the turn signal's on.
Well, that's good. You don't have to do it. Out here in California, they're not even going to put them on next year, I understand.
They're going to start leaving them off. Their cars have evolved beyond the need for turn signals.
Right.
Sort
they
of like,
don't need them out here. They're intuitive. And everybody, I guarantee you, the other thing I want to bring up with cell phones, there's going to be a lot of head cancer real soon because, you know, when they did these tests, I work with radiation. I work with it all my life. I know how long it takes before you get cancer. It takes about 15 years, 20 years with a cell phone. And so when they did all these studies, the statistic they came up with was the car wrecks go up a lot, about 800% on the cell phone. But pretty soon cancer is going to be coming along down the pike, you know, because of that. And you're going to see it everywhere.
Okay. All right, let's go to Donovan on the wild card line for Dr. Fred Bell on Coast to Coast AM. Donovan?
Hello?
Hello.
Hey. Hi, I'm Donovan I'm in Seattle.
Hi.
Cool.
Hi. I was wondering, have you ever heard of Dr. Boyd Williamson out of Cleellum?
No, not offhand.
You're not familiar with his work?
No.
Well, because he has this theory where, like, I guess he's built this device, and the whole thing behind it is kind of what the other guy was saying about, like, the protons and the neurons and stuff.
Right.
But, I don't know. He has this crazy collection of those, like, power sphere things.
Yeah.
And he tried some stuff out on me, and I got physically sick.
Well, that's probably your detoxing. Either he's using ozone therapy, which is a no-no, or you go through a detox. A lot of these new therapies take you through a detox. Not knowing his work, I really can't comment on it.
Yeah, and we just have to always
send me an email or something, you know, and I'll look into it.
We always have to remind people of this ongoing experiment with time travel that we have on the phones is always remember to turn off your radio when you're calling, or you'll be trying to simultaneously live 7.5 seconds in the past and in the present at the same time, and that never works.
It's called feedback.
Yeah. So you'll get distracted by hearing yourself say stuff on the radio, and so you'll lose it. So just make sure the radio stays off. Let's go, Kevin, west of the Rockies for Dr. Fred Bell on Coast to Coast AM. Kevin?
Yeah. Hey, guys. This is Kevin in Tempe, KFYI.
Glad to have you.
Ian, I love the show.
Thank you.
Good.
Dr. Bell, I was wondering if you're familiar with John Loengard and if you might have a comment on what's considered the alien parasite, I guess.
Well, the grays are parasites. I mean, there's a lot of different ones. I mean, if that's what you're talking about.
What are you speaking of, Kevin?
Well, specifically, I was made aware of a parasite that the grays can inflict upon certain humans that they pick out, and it's the hive mind thing and so forth, that this alien actually enters you and controls you. It's a hideous looking thing.
Is it like the bug in Wrath of Khan where Khan puts a thing in Chekhov's ear and it wraps around his cerebral cortex?
Sort of. It looks a little bit more like an octopus type of or a squid, but
well, that's what the implants look like, but they're very small. I've seen them. The implants look like sort of like an octopus. They're very small. They're about 1/8 of an inch. They're metallic in the center, and they go out into to a protein mass and from a mineral to a protein. And they actually, when they implant you, they put a hologram projector on your body with these ships where they tie people down, and what they do is they use the minerals in your body, the actual trace minerals that are located in your body, and they condense them into, like, it's very much like what we call monolithic circuitry we use in computers now. They hybridize this thing right into your body with a projection, and we use that system to in design work where we actually shoot a laser pattern into a liquid solution when we develop some of the prototypes for our projectors and receptors. We're not implanting people, but that is a technology that I personally have used, and they just micronize it. You know, I can't really go into it tonight. It takes too long, but it does exist here. We use a helium, a blue laser into a solution, and we can make very small things in metal that you normally couldn't make.
First time caller line, yeah. And I think I'm pronouncing this right, Boto?
Yes, it's Boto from Burlington, Ontario.
Boto, I think this version, can I ask you the origin of that?
Yeah, Boto is an old German name as a first name. It is related to the god of the earth, Boden. That's also related to the Norse chief god Wotan.
Thank you so much. I appreciate that. I was just curious. And you're talking with Dr. Fred Bell.
Hi, Bowden.
Hi there. Thanks very much. I've seen you a couple of times at the health shows in Toronto, at the Total Health Show and so on.
Yeah, I plan to come up there again one of these days. I love it up there with you guys. It's great. It's always cold when I come, but I'll come anyway. You know? Yeah, these guys like it cold. Go ahead.
What can you do? I've been able to scan your book, Rays of Truth, Crystals of Light.
Yeah.
And I find it pretty intriguing. And I was wondering in particular what your experiences were that drew you at first to feel that you had contact, say, with the Pleiadians.
Pleiadians?
How did you sense that and confirm it for yourself?
Well, I had memories before I took my first breath of life in the University of Michigan Hospital under the auspices of Norman Miller. I had an experience that I never forgot with the Pleiadians. And then it kind of faded into my memory, imagination for a long time, and then it kind of resurfaced in my latter days at NASA. There's a picture on one of the websites there of a Saturn II that I worked on, and I predicted that we would have a sighting before we brought that bird out of the hangar. And we brought the bird out of the hangar, the ship out of the hangar that night, and we had 450 people sight a ship that was Pleiadian. It sort of started out as intuitive. And then later on, the voices started with Semyasi, and then finally in 72, I had an actual encounter. So it was a gradual process. You know, it didn't all happen overnight, and it was a little bit uncomfortable. Then it was great. So that's basically how it happened. You know, I was highly trained, and it took a lot of years of telepathic training to get the words right, because she'd say one thing to me, and it would come out as something else. And it was a real confusing factor, but I did get it right.
And there's a lot about that in the book. I mean, at least more about the work that comes out of that. And some very interesting discussions. Let's go to James, east of the Rockies on Coast to Coast AM. James?
Good morning.
You're talking with Dr. Fred Bell.
Hello, Dr. Bell.
Hi, James.
I was very intrigued by your comments earlier on intuition.
Right.
And how it seems to me that, and I don't know if it's just out of the result of people becoming more civilized, quote unquote, or whatever, but it seems like to be more culturally correct or politically correct, we're kind of dumbed down our intuition level. And that seems to me, in thinking about it, how that kind of plays into the hands of, like, you know, the darker forces of the government or the Illuminati or whatever you want to call them.
The government plays against your intuition. Just remember that.
Yeah.
But now the government's in the fishbowl. For a long time we were, now they are. And you can see the government and how it performs as a snake or an octopus, like the other caller just said. The government is the snake at this point.
Well,
and that snake tries to kill your intuition. They try to do it with chemicals in your food, things on your billboards, scan rates on television sets. Any way they can, they try to kill it. And they know it consciously what they're doing. They even teach it in advertising. Play on the intuition.
It may come as no small surprise to you, Dr. Fred Bell, that in the last 15 minutes, we took 10 questions.
That's
10.
Great.
And you gave 10 answers on very diverse subject matter, and we will continue that coming up. We'll continue to answer the phones. We'll get as many as you on as we can. Next, with Dr. Fred Bell on Coast to Coast AM, my name's Ian Punnett. And Dr. Fred Bell, who is looking at a full boat of calls here in just a moment. And Fred, before we go any further, before we try to answer all of these questions that are online for you right now,
right?
I want to read an email to you.
Okay.
This came in last week, not because the woman who wrote it knew that you were going to be on.
Right.
But just because she was writing out of her own sincerity.
Right.
She was looking for help.
Okay.
On this. And so before you lock in your answer, let me read the whole thing.
Okay.
Okay? Comes from Edmonton, Alberta. My name is Angela, and I'm writing to you because I want to share an experience I had. Yesterday, I was at our local library sitting with my son on my lap, listening to him read. A little girl sat right in front of me at a table. She was holding a book and flipping pages, but was not reading. She was looking directly at me. She had absolutely no pages and was not reading. She was just looking at me. She had no expression on her face, but looked very, very sad. She moved her head in a very peculiar way, with her head tilted downward, almost like she did not want me to see her directly. Her eyes shifted, and occasionally she would look to the side. To break the tension, I said, "Hello," and she uttered a strained hello back. But here is the kicker, Angela writes. Her eyes were not of this world. They were not deformed. They were about 2.5 to 3 times the size of normal eyes and were a piercing blue-green. They were the most almond-shaped eyes I have ever seen on a person. What really was freaky is that they were at a 60-degree angle. Everything else about her eyes was normal from what I could see, although she looked troubled and strangely fixed on me. This lady, who I assume was her mother, but unsure of because of her age, she was about 55 plus, approached her. She asked her why she was reading French, because she does not understand French. The girl got up, without expression, almost robotic-like, but without a jerky motion, and walked around, every so once in a while glancing back at me. She grabbed a book off the shelf and threw it in the woman's basket, and off they went to check out. Another thing that troubled me is that I have no recollection of ever seeing this girl before until she sat down. Suddenly, her eyes looked very familiar, and something inside me knew I had seen those eyes before. This puzzles me, because had I any memory of this beforehand, I would have remembered it without a doubt. This has probably been the scariest encounter I have ever had, and she only sat there for 5 to 7 minutes. Who the heck was this? That's what she writes.
Very good question, isn't it? You know, it reminds me of something that happened to me when I was younger. When people would look at me, I didn't know it at the time, but they would see their future and they would get very angry, and I used to have to hide because of that. When Steven Spielberg did his series Taken, my character was depicted by the third episode called Jacob and Jesse. And in that, there were these two guys that had this ability that I somehow or other had. Since then, I have transmuted that. But my point is, in that movie, the person that narrated that entire 20-hour series was a girl named Dakota Fanning, who is almost an alien herself. And there are certain children that are being planted in this world now that behave, and their auric fields are shifting. They're moving faster in space and time. And because we move slow in space and time, we only get segues or segments of the phenomenon of their presence. This woman, for some reason, probably on a resonant level, was slowed down enough to absolutely observe this child, whereas others might not see this child at all. It's a comparison to that is you're standing out on the field, and this has happened to me before, and I look up in the sky and there's a ship, and somebody else looks up in the sky and they see nothing because the synapses in their brain are moving too slow. So it's one of those parallaxes that occurs in time occasionally, and it's a little bit weird because obviously the child was of a higher vibration.
Well, what did those eyes mean to you? As she tells the story of these eyes at a 60-degree angle, 2.5 to 3 times the size of normal human eyes, piercing blue-green, a girl that was just staring at her at this library. Based on your experiences, what do you hear in that about those eyes?
It's almost a hybrid child. I know the Pleiadian Semyonti's eyes are blue-green, and my eyes are sort of blue-green. They're not brown, they're not green, they're in between. But I know that, you know, when the Greys were abducting these kids and they were doing hybridizing and they were implanting some human females, that this child might have been one of those children. And then the giveaway is the 60 degrees in the slanting eyes and the size of the eyes, because the Greys have almond-shaped large eyes, and this probably was a hybrid child that was somehow or other DNA impregnated into a human female. And probably the woman that was with her was a guardian of some sort. And probably the child was tuning in and reading the entire auric frequency, the history of the woman that she was looking at. The woman was being scanned, basically, and that was the learning experience for the child. As far as the child being able to read French, they can read any language. They can learn these things very fast. They're very intelligent. Their IQ is completely astronomical. So it's probably a hybrid child.
And based on your...
What area was this again? What was it?
Edmonton, Alberta.
Yeah, okay, yeah, up in Canada. Yeah, it's Edmonton is an interesting place. I worked up there. The energy is very high up there. It's a very spiritual place. So this would be a good energy place for a child like that to be versus taking them down to New York City or Los Angeles. The pollution in Edmonton is much less. The people up there are quite friendly and not too inquisitive, so it would be a good place to expose a child like that, who probably has been lived in a laboratory or some kind of a breeding facility for a long period of time, and is now being brought out and aired.
In your opinion,
yeah.
What's this girl's future?
This girl probably will have some kind of a leadership position somewhere in the future, but obviously with that kind of a look, will have to be kept hidden in remote areas like where it is now. But it will have some kind of a job, and at some point the Greys, remember the Greys are trying to intermingle with humans because they really are an oversoul creature, and they really want to have individual souls. And they've been playing these games with civilizations for a long time, so I don't know how far along they've come with it, but they're genetic giants. They're incredible. I mean, we're playing around with stem cell research. What we're doing is a joke next to what the Greys do, and I've seen some of their stuff. It's amazing. It's absolutely amazing.
I'm going to have to put my pyramid hat back on. We'll come back. We'll get our next seven callers all lined up, maybe even a few more, and that'll run the table for us and Dr. Fred Bell on Coast to Coast AM, and Dr. Fred Bell here taking all of our calls, as many as we can get in. If you keep your questions short, that'll leave time for our answers. We'll go Bill west of the Rockies on Coast to Coast AM. Bill?
Hi.
Hi, you're talking to Fred.
Oh, thank you. It's a great program. I've listened to Dr. Bell for many years now. It seems like Christmas every time you come on the program.
Well, Ian is Santa Claus tonight.
Well, I was just curious about your studies on wave packets when you were talking about, I think it's more along the lines of the collective consciousness. And I know there's been a study done on like insect colonies where the queen is removed from the colony and can be removed many, many miles away, and yet the colony continues to function until the queen is killed, and then chaos breaks out.
Exactly, exactly.
You,
same with the bee, too.
You mentioned something about the red blood cells.
Right.
And the ability, I know we have the ability to go back in our immature red blood cells to de-differentiate back to become a bone or skin or liver or whatever. How is that related to this collective consciousness related to the red blood cells?
Well, the red blood cell is carries an intelligence, a DNA intelligence, the entire body. It's a very, very important thing, you know. And so what happens is when we work with these devices, the red blood cell is affected. Now, I'll give you an example real quick. We do a muscle test, and we'll have somebody, we'll stand up, and they'll put their arm straight out, and we'll push their arm down to see what their strength is. Give them some glue, and like bad toxic glue, and we'll push their arm down, and it collapses. Then we'll put one of these nuclear receptors, which is a DNA transmitting device. It's a scalar wave device, and they'll test strong even though they're breathing glue because they're wearing this thing because it's changing the red blood cell. And what happens is when you look at the red blood cell under a microscope, when you put this glue into the system without this outside force to counteract it, it changes the shape of the heme itself. The iron atom is deformed, and when it's deformed, the oxygen, hydrogen, nitrogen that it controls, which runs all the elements of the body, can no longer keep into their proper orbit. So what happens is you get an absolute collapse of the entire model of the human red blood cell. And that's just one example of many. So with the technology that we have, it adjusts that to make it normal. It keeps to normalize it while we're under this environmental toxic stress. And that's kind of like the gist of what I do. And that's in the book, Rays of Truth. And it translates to life extension to some people. And it translates to a lot of different things, but that's basically what that is.
Thank you. Very interesting. on that idea about the queen, too, just to go back to that thought.
I got a whole – I mean, we make a thing called a fire star orb. And someday I'll get to explain that on your show. We don't have time tonight, but it's amazing. And it has to do with the queen bee and everything. And I did a huge thing with the University of Hamburg in Germany on this. I had a whole college participate in one of my experiments.
Mike on the wild card line on Coast to Coast AM. Mike, you're talking to Dr. Fred Bell.
Excellent. Good evening.
Evening.
Welcome back to the Ianator and Dr. Fred Bell.
Hi.
I was just curious, Ian, just before you left us a couple of years ago, I asked you if you'd seen a movie, Zardoz, with Sean Connery about living forever. Did you ever
see that? No, I went to kind of try to find that, actually. It's funny you should mention that. And none of the local places that I frequent had it, and it would have had to have gotten it from the web. But I think at that point I just sort of lost track of that idea. But I did go to look for it.
Yeah. Dr. Bell.
Yeah.
Coast to Coast AM has had guests like Daniel Pinchbeck, Terrence McKenna, and Dr. Strassman on the air talking about a substance called DMT. At higher dosages, people report having alien contacts. My question, sir, is are you aware, if you are aware of DMT, are you aware of how it would interact with your body, meaning would there be potentially any mental or physical side effects?
Very toxic. It's a dimethyltoluene. It's very toxic. It does what it does is it gives you, it shuts off the serotonin. It displaces serotonin. It's usually smoked, taken in the smoke form, and it displaces serotonin rather quickly. So it's like a very intense LSD trip. Remember, the CIA did all kinds of experimentation along with PCP during the Cold War and Russians too, because of the psychoactive. It's a very powerful psychoactivator, which brings you up into a different consciousness, which allows you to see all kinds of things. And sometimes there are subtle influences from extraterrestrials on certain individuals, and that will cause temporary manifestation. But it's highly toxic, and I recommend you don't do it that way. It has tremendous side effects.
Mike?
Appreciate him answering the question. Thanks for your time, guys.
No, thank you. I think that's good advice, too. And I will go take a look for Zardoz. I'm glad you reminded me. Stuart, Wildcard Line, Coast to Coast AM for Dr. Fred Bell. Stuart?
Yes, sir. Oh, hi, Dr. Bell.
Hi, Stuart.
You're answering the question about the cell phones and the brain cancer made me wonder about what microwave ovens and the food that comes out of them might be doing to us and our bodies.
They're dead food, cooked for the inside out. Everything likes to be left spin. Left spin is the necessary for the body to the cells to reproduce in the proper. And microwave is a right spin. It's lava rotary versus dextral rotary, and so it's not good for you at all. And what it does is that when you put that food in your body, it actually destroys the nutrition. And another thing I might add while we're on that topic, if you look at milk and things like that with vitamin A and vitamin D added, that's synthetic, and when you drink it, it takes it out of your body and gives you heart problems. And that's one of the big things that the government's trying to do now is give the pharmacies the ability to produce vitamins, and you have to get them by prescription. They're all going to be synthetic, and they will rob your nutrition. It's just another form of death.
Right.
Interesting,
and thank you, Stuart, for that. Have you noticed this pattern of people tonight, just in the last hour, bringing up to you various types of research or quoting other scientists and other work?
Yeah.
There's been a pattern this hour.
Yeah, that's okay. I don't mind it. I like it.
I think you should be very flattered by that.
I am. I'm flattered by the listeners out there. I've always loved this show because I don't know where they come from. We even had a Gray on here tonight. I mean, that was great, you know. You know, the person had to be touched by one to behave that way, which is fine, you know. It takes all kinds to make the world turn. So I enjoy the heck out of it. I think it's great.
Let's go to
I don't care.
Linda on the wild card line. Linda?
Hi.
Hi, Linda.
I really enjoy your show and listening to you, Ian.
Thank you.
And I think I'll be a pinky. Dr. Bell, I read your book years ago, and I just can't believe I'm talking to the author.
Oh, good.
I thought it was so unique the way you wrote it and how the letters and the grounding, I still remember it. And here's the strange thing. I was thinking that book. I don't have it now, but I thought, I remember, now be here. And that has helped me through so many things. Never mind there. Now be here.
Now be here. Very interesting.
Was that The Rays of Truth or was that the Death of Ignorance book that you read? Which book did you read of mine, The Death of Ignorance or The Rays of Truth?
I think The Rays of Truth.
Okay, yeah. It was called The Secret Promise when I first came out. I just wondered, you know.
Thank you, Linda. That's very interesting.
Linda.
Now be here. Tony, now be here on the first time caller line for us.
Dr. Bell, you're awesome.
Oh, thank you, Tony.
Thank you. I got a kind of a grand slam question for you real quick.
Yeah.
Tell me, why is ozone therapy a no-no? What do you
think very quick. It's subtractive poisoning, sure. You know, if, for example, let's say you're a smoker, and you're going to use ozone therapy to kill all the bacteria that's growing in your body from it. You take one hit of ozone in there, and it's a poison, and it destroys the poison inside of your body. Then what happens is it leaves your lungs raw. Now you take another hit of ozone, and now it's going to be destructive. So it's a subtractive process where you take a poison to kill a poison, and then you remove it and let the body heal itself. That's why even, for example, when they treat AIDS and cancer with it, they put it in the bloodstream. It's done by therapists. It's only put in there, in the bloodstream, long enough to kill the viruses because AIDS is a virus. And then after that, they take it out, and it's very successful. But you put too much in, it'll kill you. And what's really bad is companies like Alpine took my early ion designs. I was the one that turned Richard Thalheimer on originally. He owned Sharper Image to ionization years ago. And I developed a unit that had a filter in it. Well, some guy came along and put an ozone machine in it, and that was terrible. It was taking a beautiful design and destroying it. So that I hope that answers your question.
Well, you should go back then to making the original version of it.
Well, Richard's done such a great job with the Ion Breeze.
Okay.
I'm not plugging his product, but it really works. And now they've got this ozone arrestor on it. They're coming up with a new design. So I'm really proud of him. I'm honored when people take my ideas and bring them in and make lots of money with them because it's just, you know, I know I made that stuff originally, and it's great. I just feel great. Another company up in Canada, I forget the name of them now, started years ago. What's the name of that company? I did so much ionization work back in the 80s and 70s. It's all over the place now. So there's some really creative designs out there. I'm more concentrating on the hologram stuff now. That seems to be where the world needs to go. So that's where my energy is.
Then I imagine 10 years from now we'll be buying that at Sharper Image, too.
Yeah, you probably will.
Robert, east of the Rockies, now be here for Dr. Fred Bell.
Good morning. Wonderful program, gentlemen.
Oh, thank you.
I take it for granted before my question you're talking about negative ionization.
Right.
And my question, two quickies. First of all, I've been told a long time ago that when you have your food placed across the scanner on a countertop at the checkout, that destroys enzymes in your food. My next question is, lastly, is if any of your investigations or whatever involved the works of Nikola Tesla?
A lot of Tesla. As a matter of fact, when I used to stay in New York City in the New Yorker Hotel, I used to stay, I think it was room 2338, that's the room he died in, and I used to go in there and channel his energy. So I'm very familiar with his work. I've studied him A to Z. When I was 6 years old, I was studying Nikola Tesla. He was one of my mentors. His work was brilliant.
How about
his work with gravity?
How about the band Tesla?
The what?
The band Tesla.
I'm not familiar with
them. Not familiar with them?
Yeah. I have a band called the Black Sheep Squadron.
I've heard a little bit about your music.
Voyager. I play music. Matter of fact, one time I almost played the bagpipes on this show. George ambushed me to play the clarinet, but that's as far as I've gone.
Well,
someday I'll do the bagpipes.
We may twist your arm in that direction,
too,
sometime. No. I think we got them almost all in. I'm afraid if we stranded anybody, they can always email and they can find out more at coasttocoastam.com. Link up to Dr. Fred Bell there. Thank you so much, Fred. Enjoyed this enormously.
I had a blast. It was great.
And I'll be using Now Be Here in your honor for a while on the phones, okay?
Great, and I will send you that power dome.
Deus te mat. We do too.